representation of what the followers of oppressors and tyrants of our time want for Islam, which are terrorists operating as tools of our time's main oppressor, the United States. In 2016, they left Daraya to Idlib, leaving total destruction behind. But their departure reflected their ultimate defeat. It was resistance by the Syrian army and its allies that led to their victory.
Islamic resistance all around the world raised the flag of righteousness and defeated Takfiri terrorism, Israel and the US. The resistance in Lebanon and Syria derived its power from Imam Hussein's revolution in Ashura, which created the philosophy of freedom and liberation.
Sayyida Sukaina is the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the sister of Imam Hussein, who led a historic and peaceful uprising against the tyrant Yazid. He was martyred in 680 AD along with his companions, while his family members were brutally taken as captives from one city to another. Syria is a country that hosts a large number of holy Islamic sites. Takfiri terrorists' Islamic disguise was eventually unveiled, and the truth was revealed that they are just agents of the West. If it wasn't for the resistance movement and fighters who follow the path of Imam Hussein, probably many other sites, like Sayyida Zainab Shrine, would have been destroyed. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border. Afghan refugees have just crossed into Iran, a country they call a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak crossing point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 on the pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
"24 hours after the first plane carrying Italian nationals and diplomatic staff arrived in Rome from Kabul, top officials from Italy's government expressed their opinions about the Afghan crisis. Prime Minister Mario Draghi stressed the importance of preventing terrorism from spreading and protecting Afghan civilians and those who worked with the international community. Separately, the head of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Luigi Di Maio, called on Western countries to seriously reflect on the mistakes made during the US-led occupation that went on in the landlocked Central Asian country for 20 years. Analysts and commentators have also been deeply critical of Washington and its allies.
Il tradimento.
Betrayal. That's all Afghans are left with. All of their expectations have been betrayed. The ethical failure comes even before the political one. After 10 years, the U.S. had finally killed bin Laden in 2011. Why did they stay in Afghanistan? To export democracy? In the interest of whom?
About 50,000 Italian soldiers were deployed to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, making Italy one of the countries most involved in the region, along with the United States, Turkey, Britain, and Germany.
It was on December 30, 2001, when the Italian military arrived in the area entrusted to them by the U.S., the quadrant of Herat, in the northwest of Afghanistan. The number of Italian soldiers killed since the beginning of the U.S. occupation is 53.
Also, about 700 Italian soldiers have remained seriously or permanently injured. The mistakes made by the U.S. in Afghanistan include handing government posts to sycophants or corrupt figures.
Italians were puzzled after U.S. President Joe Biden's recent statements, in which he admitted that the reason for staying in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's killing was not to rebuild the country, but to prevent other terrorist threats from arising there.
I have been very much disappointed by what both Biden and Blinken said about the drawdown. Biden's shift from nation-building to limited counter-terrorist strikes in Afghanistan is very hypocritical. Many of us were there to rebuild a ravaged country. I hope European members will finally work towards creating a European Union military force. It's the only way we can have our say on international issues.
Italy's foreign ministry has said it is now working on a coordinated international initiative in Afghanistan to ensure humanitarian flights and make sure to tackle the emergency in an organized manner. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jail's military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners' relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Harabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Hey, yo, hey! Scores of Shia Muslims were injured and many more were arrested after government forces resorted to batons to file a mourning procession in the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities had imposed strict restrictions and blocked several entry and exit points in Srinagar to prevent the traditional event held on the 8th Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar. Defying restrictions, hundreds of people, some holding flags, poured onto the streets at several places in the city center. However, police attacked them and fired several rounds of tear gas shells to disperse the mourners.
All over Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussain slogans.
The police also beat journalists covering the event. For the last three decades, the authorities have banned the traditional 8th Muharram and Ashura processions in the main city, citing security reasons. Despite repeated pleas by religious bodies over the years, the ban has not been lifted till date. This year, the authorities had initially hinted at lifting the ban, but later denied permission to take out the procession.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiris people have made it very clear that they will not accept the ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
The authorities say that the procession stoke anti-India sentiments and pose, quote, serious security threats. But the people here argue that if the authorities can allow the annual Hindu pilgrimage that attracts over 500,000 people, why not Muslim processions? Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to 1527 AD.
It's been 32 years and the status quo is intact. Every year, mourners defy restrictions and get thrashed in return. Religious bodies have strongly condemned the use of force against the peaceful mourners and termed the ban as a blatant breach of religious freedom and demanded its immediate withdrawal. Sayyidina Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union. You know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others, they brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Pariza, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is looking forward to activating two comprehensive cooperation agreements with Moscow and Beijing. In two separate conversations, President Raisi told his Russian and Chinese counterparts that the priority of his foreign policy would be to strengthen strategic relations with Moscow and Beijing. Raisi told Vladimir Putin that Iran was looking forward to raising the relations of the two countries to a level that makes it a successful model for neighboring relations. Raisi told President Xi that raising the level of cooperation and developing relations with China was also a priority for his government. All three presidents touched on the discussions to revive the 2015 nuclear agreement. President Raisi also said that Tehran is ready to cooperate with the two countries to establish stability and peace in Afghanistan.
As Iran prepares for a new administration to take shape, the world is curious to know more about the country's foreign policy in the years to come. After his election, President Ebrahim Raisi signaled that his foreign policy will aim at boosting relations with neighboring countries and friendly nations. And now, the president's opening moves support those words. especially when he held first phone calls with his Chinese and Russian counterparts on Wednesday. In his talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping, Raisi described the Sino-Iranian relations as a priority for his government. Raisi said the implementation of the 25-year Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement signed in March should be high on the two countries' agenda. In his conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, Raisi said the strengthening of relations with Moscow is key to Iran's foreign policy. Raisi also said his government has a serious will to finalize the comprehensive document of Iran-Russia cooperation at the earliest. During the phone calls, Raisi thanked both Russia and China for supporting Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, describing it as a step towards strengthening relations with the two countries. The Chinese and Russian leaders, on their part, voiced eagerness to further strengthen ties and friendship with Tehran, saying they attach great significance to the development of relations. It seems the successful conclusion of Vienna talks on the 2015 nuclear deal will serve another practical indicator of Iran's path over the next 4 years. In his inaugural speech, Raisi had underlined that his government would seek to remove U.S. sanctions, but would not tie the nation's standard of living to the will of foreigners.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have Southwest Asia Coordinator for the Schiller Institute, Hossein Askeri, joining us from Stockholm. And also, we have political and economic commentator Shebi Rizvi joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Askeri in Stockholm. Sir, will we be seeing a boost in cooperation with Beijing and Moscow under a Raisi administration?
Thank you very much for inviting me for this exciting program. The answer is definitely yes, because not only that Iran's policy is, it doesn't change with the changes in by time on events, but also the world has changed so much that everything you have mentioned in the introduction in the program is now playing out. And Iran's role is going to be very, very important in the coming period, given what just happened in Afghanistan. And I really believe, and I think the Iranian leadership, both the previous and the current, will have been wise to build these special ties with both China and Russia. These are not something which just came yesterday or last March. These have been in the workings for a long time, because the world outside Eurasia, so to speak, or West Asia, has been acting aggressively to establish a very unsuccessful and dangerous world order, which is now we see is falling apart and is opening the door for a new kind of relations among nations, which will be based on mutual respect, respect for the sovereignty and independence of nations, but most and foremost will be based on economic cooperation. And China's Belt and Road Initiative and kind of cooperation now is inaugurated with Iran, and also Iran's relationship to Russia, which will move from being a security kind of relationship into a more economic cooperation relationship. This will affect the whole region around Iran, but also all of Eurasia, and it will have ramifications for the international order.
Sure, Mr. Razvi in London. Some analysts, they've argued that President Raisi will have a quote-unquote look east strategy in his foreign policy, which obviously means closer cooperation with China and Russia. In what aspects, in your opinion, can Iran's relations with China and Russia further develop?
Hello, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, particularly talking on this very important issue that's taking place in West Asia and Central Asia. Look, what one has to analyze, as our friend from Stockholm was saying, not only has Iran been wise, but it has also been patient, because the atrocities, as you know, that were committed by Taliban 20 years ago on Iranian personnel in Mazar-e-Sharif, Iran hasn't sort of really pursued that. and it has continuously tried to create a better relationship with Afghanistan. And what one's got to really look at it before coming on, what it sort of entails for the future, is that you've got to remember that America wanted chaos, but it did not happen after the 15th of August. America wanted civil war, and it is prevented so far. America wanted destabilizing the region by destabilizing Afghanistan, and against the will of USA, to have a spillover effect in the neighboring countries like Iran, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, China, and perhaps also Russia. So at all those sort of four points that I have listed, and there are numerous others where American policy has totally failed in that region. China, Iran, Russia, and to some extent Pakistan are on the same page at this moment for greater interest of the region, like CPAC. And regional bloc withdrawal of America will facilitate this cause. And of course, you've got to look at it that Afghanistan is a very wealthy nation as far as mineral resources are concerned, and rare minerals which are now required in the environment that we are living in, where everyone is concerned about pollution, about climate change, and everything moving towards a sort of more natural resources of power and energy rather than fossil fuels that we have become addicted over the last 100 years. So here again, there would be immense benefit for Iran, and not only Iran, but the whole of West Asia and Central Asia. Because what you've got to remember is that if there's a war going on, if there is chaos in the region, if I don't know that my child going to school is going to come back home safely, then people are not able to focus on economic issues and economic well-being. They're more concerned about security. And if Afghanistan, under the Taliban Mark II or 2.0, as people are dubbing, performs as they have been doing in the last week or so, it really is a good sign. And just to illustrate that particular change of approach that Taliban has taken, as you know, in the last couple of days, we've had Ashura on Thursday, and there hasn't been any report of any killing or any bombing of Shias, who constitute a substantial majority in Afghanistan. Whether they are Pashtuns, there are some Shias in there. And then you've obviously got the Hazara community, and even some northern alliance individuals are also of that ilk. So the reality is that, as I said in the beginning, America wanted chaos. But really, if the last week is anything to go by, and what Taliban have been saying is that they want foreign troops out of their country and want to focus on the betterment of the nation, both at the economic level and at a global level.
Mr. Askeri, Iran, Russia, China, they further discussed the prospect of resuming talks on the JCPOA. What kind of a role can the two play, being Moscow and Beijing, in helping restore the nuclear deal?
Well, I think China and Russia have been very instrumental from the beginning in getting the JCPOA going. And they have kept a very good relationship with Iran. They are trustworthy allies, but also they are trustworthy in the international arena. They do what they promise to do, and they don't have any ill intentions towards any party. Now, in the coming period, I think given the situation in the world, as your guest also has been describing, that the Western policies, especially of the United States, Britain, and their allies have failed, now people will think twice now about trying to create new problems with Iran or with other regional powers in the region. So I think now the door is open to offer the West, the United States, and others, especially from the standpoint of Russia and China, a deal that they cannot refuse, because Iran is an instrumental country. both in its own neighborhood, but also for the whole region and internationally. It's very important for Russia and China that their role is concretized by not simply trying to renegotiate the whole thing. That was the problem with the previous American administration, that they wanted to renegotiate the whole thing. I think the JCPOA was the best deal the West could get. It was very good for Iran. It was very good for everybody. But the previous administration withdrew from the agreement. They wanted to renegotiate. There is nothing to renegotiate. Iran has its obligations. They fulfilled their obligations. Now it's the international community have to fulfill their obligations. And it's in the benefit of the international community if we get a new, or we go back to the JCPOA and have a stable relationship with Iran. We have economic cooperation in the whole region. And I think Russia and China's role in this concern has augmented, has multiplied exactly because of what your guest said, what happened in Afghanistan recently.
Ms. Razvi, looking at how the recent negotiations have unfolded in Vienna, do you see a genuine effort by the U.S. to get back into the deal? Just recently, in this phone conversation that President Ebrahim Raisi had with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, Mr. Putin said on the Vienna talks that the agreement, quote, cannot be held hostage to problems not related to the nuclear deal. What does that say about the intentions of the United States?
Well, look, at the end of the day, the United States is not a trustworthy partner on any deal. And that has become very clear over the nuclear deal that happened with Iran. If you look at it historically, and I want to put it in historic context, whether the USA made treaties with the natives of America, they rescinded those agreements. And continuously, US has abandoned, has sort of really not kept up to its word. I think what is interesting also to look at is that the current government of Ağa Raisi and the Rehber and the Majlis, the three, if you like, corners of the political system in Iran, are all on the same page. Yes, in the previous government, they did whatever they could in the best and honest way. But the reality is that Tehran and the neoliberal elements in the Iranian government and the sort of decision makers must perhaps now realize that East is where things are happening. The economic power is being predicted by many economists that by 2030, without any doubt, China would be the premier economic power on this planet. Secondly, Iran is closer to all those countries, if you look at it, the former Southern Russian republics. Why on earth, I can't imagine that any elements in Iranian elite think that Washington, Paris, or NATO will ever support them, because Iran, the revolution in Iran in 1979 was really a slap in the face to the imperialist power, and they really, for the last 42 years, have tightened the screw on Iran economically and through a whole host of instruments that they have used. So I think if there were any neoliberal elements in the Iranian political system, they should really abandon the policy and the thinking that they have had in the past and to focus on East. This is where the future of Iran lies. That's where the future of the really global economic well-being depends. And really, USA over the years has shown whether the war in Vietnam or whether what they have been doing with Cuba for the last 60 years shows that any agreement with USA is not really based on honest and with integrity. So if you have a partner which has a history of being dishonest and has no integrity, Why would one keep on negotiating and playing with that player? And just to say that, you know, Einstein really encapsulated what I'm trying to say, that if you keep on doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result, that's a sign of madness. And I suspect the powers in Tehran are not mad at all. As I said earlier, they're wise and patient. Therefore, I think wisdom will prevail and show them that really, Iran's well-being, its people's prosperity lies in the East.
Mr. Aschetti, I saw you nodding there. Should the U.S. be trusted again?
Well, I don't think that's really the question. The question is if the United States will learn again. I want to just explain a couple of things. Your guest has also emphasized what's going on in Afghanistan. But if we look at the discussions between President Ayatollah Raisi and the Chinese president and the Russian president, what are the major points were economic cooperation, the JCPOA, but also the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and also the situation in Afghanistan. Except for the JCPOA, all these matters, they come together right now. Now, some people compare what happened in Afghanistan to what happened in Vietnam in Saigon 1975, when Americans and their allies were evacuated by helicopters. The scenes in Kabul this week looked like Saigon, but I warned people, and the chairman of our institute, Mrs. Helge Seplarush, said this is not like Saigon. This is like the fall of the Wall of Berlin, because what happened in Afghanistan means is that an era has ended where the unipolar world, which followed the fall of the Berlin Wall, is now collapsing. It has failed in every aspect, not only in military, strategic, and economic, but also, I mean, in economic and financial terms. So it's up to the United States and Europe and their allies to learn the lessons of history. Now, the reason I say this is not Vietnam 1975 is that at that time, or at the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was a lost chance. At the time, we didn't have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, we didn't have the Belt and Road Initiative or the New Silk Road to replace this failed system. And our institute, since actually the fall of the Berlin Wall, have been calling for a new world order based on building bridges between Asia, Europe, and Africa, which now has become the new Silk Road or the Eurasian Land Bridge. Now, Mrs. Helge Seplarush, the chairman of our institute, played a key role, and her husband, Mr. LaRouche, in propagating for this idea that we need to have a new international economic order based on economic cooperation, but also based on respecting the sovereignty of nations. It's very interesting if you look at what happened in Afghanistan. I was fascinated by some pictures of Pakistani, Chinese, Iranian, and Russian ambassadors in Kabul, sitting quietly, calmly, and drinking tea and having a very nice discussion, in contrast to all the European, American, and other foreign embassy personnel who were fleeing in panic. This was a very good picture to show where things are heading. It's not up to us or the Iranians or the Asians to trust the United States. It's up to the United States and the Europeans to learn the lesson that you cannot and should not use military force in Asia. This is a failed policy. The best thing you can do is to have economic cooperation and respect the sovereignty and independence of those nations. And I think in the coming period, what we will see is that the Iran, Pakistan, China, Russia, Central Asian nations, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization,
sure,
will, as I call it, embrace Afghanistan to make sure that Afghanistan's economy is reconstructed. And this is the offer to make to the Taliban or whoever comes into power in Afghanistan, that
good
the best
there.
Thing they can do is to rely on their neighbors and their own environment rather than rely on foreign behind the seas forces.
Mr. Azmi, in London, one more thing that was discussed with both presidents of China and Russia, that was preparations for the SCO, which was brought up by Mr. Ascheti, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, and Iran's official request to join that organization. As we know, Russia has launched a mechanism for Tehran's formal membership. China has expressed support for that as well. Tell us more about the ramifications of such an accession.
Yes, as far as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is concerned, Iran has been an observer for the last few years. But as you quite rightly pointed out, Moscow wants Iran to have full membership. That is very, very important. However, before sort of focusing on your question, I just want to comment on one thing that our dear friend in Stockholm was saying, that would Washington, Paris, London, and NATO take lessons from what happens coming on TV and other channels in UK and espousing really nothing different. Crocodile tears have been all over the place for the poor people who are trying to escape from Afghanistan. What the biggest challenge that the West faces, and I am someone who's lived here all my life, grew up here, and I can see that it's the malaise of hubris. That's what I like to call it. It's the malaise of hubris that does not allow the academia, the journalists, the think tanks to think outside their own echo chambers. Until that happens, I think there is a problem where the West may continue to do the same thing, apply the same thing, and hoping for different results. So long as they abandon their own psychological issue of hubris, then I think we are really working at parallel with what's happening in the West.
Apologies, I'm going to have to jump in there. We're running short of time for this program. Allow me to thank my guests. Southwest Asia coordinator for the Schiller Institute, Hossein Ascheti, joining us from Stockholm. Thanks to political and economic commentator Shebi Rezvi, joining us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Amnesty International, in a recently released report, said the Biden administration has shamefully continued the Trump administration's policy of misusing the Title 42 public health authority to block and expel people at the border, recklessly endangering lives. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "There is no excuse. Amnesty slams Biden over skyrocketing ICE detentions and more than 400,000 expulsions." Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's treatment of refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants not only falls short of expectations, but is in urgent need of course correction, particularly its growing reliance on mass detention and widespread denial of access to people requesting protection at the U.S. southern border. Amnesty International USA argues in a new report released recently. President Joe Biden assumed office pledging a fair and humane immigration system, placing racial justice and human rights at the heart of his vision, begins Amnesty's report. Needs improvement, a progress report on the Biden administration record on making the United States a safe refuge. His promised agenda was a stark contrast to that of former President Donald Trump's administration, which used xenophobia to justify punitive and cruel policies that dismantled access to protection for many people. Nevertheless, the Biden administration has yet to act boldly to undo the Trump administration's harm and restore humanity in how the U.S. treats refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants, says the report. It comes just days after Vice President Kamala Harris discouraged would-be Central American migrants attempting to escape poverty, violence, and extreme weather, factors that are inseparable from decades of U.S. intervention in the region, including the promotion of neoliberal policies and genocidal right-wing dictatorships from fleeing to the U.S. Researchers at Amnesty analyzed the Biden administration's approach to six components of the immigration system: immigration detention, access to asylum at the border, unaccompanied children, climate displacement, refugee protection, and temporary protected status. Most alarmingly, the administration needs to immediately reverse its direction on immigration detention, where it is rapidly going backwards, and fully restore access to asylum at the U.S. southern border, where it continues to maintain the Trump administration's policy of blocking and expelling people at the border. Failure to act and course correct is a betrayal to people seeking safety. Emphasizing that the drastic rise in the number of detained people reflects how the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, is reverting back to a blanket use of detention for people arriving at the border, the report notes that shortly after President Biden took office, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, reported detaining 13,860 people on February 5th. As of June 18th, the number of people ICE reported detaining has skyrocketed 82% to 25,238. His proposed budget for fiscal year 2022 funds detention space for 32,500 beds. Returning to Obama administration levels of detention is not progress. It is history repeating itself. In addition, the report points out the Biden administration has shamefully continued the Trump administration's policy of misusing the Title 42 Public Health Authority to block and expel people at the border recklessly, endangering lives. There is no public health rationale to treat immigrants and asylum seekers differently, and it is causing irreparable harm to them, the authors wrote. The welcoming of unaccompanied children at the border while continuing the expulsion of families and individuals has created family separation. The report states, between March 2020 and May 2021, the government summarily expelled nearly 875,000 people, particularly affecting black immigrants and asylum seekers. The Biden administration has expelled over 400,000 of those people. This misuse of Title 42 continues despite objections by CEC officials and against the recommendations of public health experts. All of this was entirely unnecessary and violates U.S. obligations to uphold the right to seek asylum and not forcibly return individuals to a place where they would be at risk of serious human rights harm. According to Amnesty, recent statements suggest the Biden administration will continue to rely on mass detention for people arriving at the border, particularly when it ceases to misapply the Title 42 public health quarantine to block access to safely at the border. The report notes the Biden administration must act much faster to move children from these emergency intake sites and close them down altogether. Emergency care is not suitable for the long term. It is a stopgap measure for discrete, short periods. In addition, the report notes the Biden administration continues to misuse the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act to immediately return almost all unaccompanied Mexican children to Mexico. CBP is failing to adequately consider the protection needs of Mexican children by forcibly returning them and belaying the administration's commitment to welcome children seeking safety. The Human Rights Organization also calls on the Biden administration to more robustly grant humanitarian protection through Temporary Protected Status, TPS, to protect people already in the U.S. from forced return to their countries of origin because of ongoing armed conflict, extraordinary and temporary conditions, and environmental disasters. Nearly half a year in, the administration has still not delivered on change that has not only been promised but is of the utmost urgency. Dennis Bell, researcher for refugee and migrant rights at Amnesty International USA, said in a statement, "There is no excuse that can get the United States government out of its human rights obligations. While systematic reform that respects human rights means explicitly addressing the racism underlying the U.S. immigration system, authors of the report wrote, current policies that perpetuate deterrence, detention, and deportation do the opposite and must be eliminated to end the systematic harms against black and brown communities." For each of the six immigration policy arenas examined in the report, Amnesty made specific recommendations. Some of the group's proposed solutions include immediately stop expelling individuals and families under Title 42, end the use of arbitrary mass detention, and incorporate a presumption of liberty in custody determinations, with asylum seekers and immigrants allowed to live in the community, supported by sponsors and community-based programs operated by nonprofits to assist individuals in navigating the immigration process. Release people held in immigration detention through an affirmative file review process with a presumption of liberty, prioritizing people who are most at risk of harm in custody, including families and children, HIV plus individuals, pregnant women, and those at heightened risk of contracting COVID-19. Phase out IC contracts with private prison companies and county jails. End family detention and close all three family detention centers. Continue to urgently address conditions at emergency intake sites and raise the standard of care to meet children's best interest, while implementing changes to safely release them faster from such sites, and communicating a transparent plan to stop their use altogether and ensure that unaccompanied Mexican children are given fair and meaningful access to asylum, as all unaccompanied children and people seeking safety should be and not turned back, with summary and inadequate considerations of their protection needs.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.